60s. So very valuable commodity. The emancipation, though, of African Americans did not bring about any type of economic freedom. There were continual policies to make sure that they never got their rights, starting off, of course, with not getting the 40 acres and a mule. However, the slave owners in the South, they actually got compensation after the Civil War, $300 per slave loss or freed. And throughout the time, the safety nets for other Americans was never in place for African Americans, not the loans, not the access to affordable housing in good neighborhoods. There was redlining to prevent them. And even when they could take off a little and be successful in some type of business, as we see like Black Wall Street, then there were efforts to totally eliminate and annihilate any type of success that they had. I mean, this is just a very, very small example of some of the reasons why African Americans are demanding reparations.
Kalonji Jamachanga currently serves as co-chair of the Urban Survival and Preparedness Institute and is co-founder of Black Power Media. He has fought on multiple fronts, tackling issues from local and national police brutality cases to international human rights violations. Under Kalonji's direction, as founder and national coordinator of the FTP movement, programs such as International Feed the People and the National Coalition to Combat Police Terrorism have matured and developed. He has shared his experiences in the best-selling book, How to Build a People's Army, and the documentary, Organizing is the New Cool.
Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files, Mr. Kalonji Jamachanga. What's your perspective in general regarding reparations?
You know, when I think of reparations, you know, most people think reparations is money. That's not what we're talking about. Our first order of operation is our political prisoners, because like any other civilized nation, whenever there is war or there's any type of, fighting or what have you, any type of disagreements, the first thing before anything can go down is they want their captives back. You know what I mean? So we want our political prisoners back first and foremost. And it is my belief that if we are, the question around reparations should also include the continent of Africa. I think that, the first thing should be, they should be paying reparations to folks on the continent because they stole not only the land, not only the minerals and the wealth, they stole us, they stole humans, you know? So we totally believe that reparations should be paid, but will it be paid? We don't believe this country is capable of that type of accountability or respect for us as a whole.
What type of reparations in general do you think would be necessary?
You know, land is definitely, you know, is necessary. You know, we're not just talking about some cash, because we know that the U.S. dollar doesn't mean anything. And we know that if they gave us reparations with cash, then they'll just raise the prices up. They'll hike the prices up. You know, so, you know, that's a foolish notion that all we want is money. You know, we know that the American dollar has no real value across the globe. They place their own value on it. You know, so we don't want anything that they can take away. What we'd really like you said, is to be left alone. What we really like is to folks to say, you know what, we want to return these goods. We want to make good with our people. But we know that under a capitalist society, we know that capitalism is a violent system. You cannot have capitalism without the pain and suffering of others. They package it well. They make you feel comfortable and make you feel like, you know, yes, you should be a part of the capitalist system and you should grow and, you know, everything's going to be all right. But it's not the case. They let a few quote unquote African-Americans and a few so-called minorities, or should we say other oppressed people, give them the illusion of power. And, you know, power is about self-determination. So if you don't have self-determination, and you don't have a place of your own, and you don't have your own tongue and your own culture, then again, you are a displaced person. You are a person that's running around trying to find themselves. And that is how they have us right now. So we're talking about 500 years of this practice of terrorism. So we must understand that, unfortunately, in this country in particular, when you are, you know, their success has to equal your failure. Someone has to be at the bottom and someone has to be at the top. And in the capitalist system, the folks at the bottom will always get stepped on in order to benefit those who are at the top, the oppressors.
In your perspective, what are some of the systemic efforts that have taken place in order to prevent African Americans from achieving equality?
The whole notion of equality is a myth, because we were brought here as chattel slaves, as surplus labor. We were brought here as, you know, as and treated like domesticated animals, you know. So they looked at us as property. They never looked at us as equal, you know. Even in on paper, they said we were 3/5 of human beings. They didn't even consider us a human being. Matter of fact, the quote unquote forefathers of this country, they treated us like objects, you know. Even when you talk about folks like George Washington, these are, you know, most of the men who happen to be on the money here, the dollar bills and the cash and the coins, these are former slave masters. You know, these are folks who gave away Africans, and we don't consider ourselves slaves. We were enslaved, because we weren't slaves when we encountered these folks. So we were enslaved Africans. So, you know, so yeah, so these are folks who literally gave us away. George Washington's wife gave Africans away for wedding gifts. They gave us away like we were poodles, or like we were some type of plants, or some type of exotic horse. You know what I'm saying? Like we were camels. We were treated as nothing more than, you know, like I said, domesticated animals. Like we were tricks. We performed for these people. We worked for these people. We built for these people. And in turn, we were enslaved. We were tortured. And to this very day, we are victims of a systematic oppression, which, again, stems from capitalism and global white supremacy. This is what it's all about. You know, capitalism and enslavement are Siamese twins.
We're just about out of time, Mr. Tshanga, but do you have any final thoughts?
I would like to say that people of the world, oppressed people, quote unquote, third world people, we have to resist imperialism at every turn. We have to, you know, like it says in Islam, we have to change things with our hands. And if we can't change it with our hands, we have to speak out against it. And if we don't speak out against it, then we at least have to hate it in our hearts. We have to remember that we are here for a limited time, and we have the right to exist. We have the right to love. We have the right to be our natural selves. And no man, woman, or child should be able to exploit, dominate, or oppress us.
Very powerful words. Thank you so much for being with us right here on Hidden Files. From 1619, when the first Africans were enslaved in what would become the United States, until the present, Africans and their descendants in that country have never been considered as equals with their white counterparts. They have been the victims of systemic terrorism as they have built that country, and now they are demanding their fair share of it. Will they get reparations? Will their demands be met? Not likely, but we will continue to follow their story, their cases, and their demands for justice. And we'll bring you all the latest on that right here at Hidden Files. And make sure you join me and the team next week as we dig into another Hidden File. I'm Marzia Hashimi. Goodbye for now.
Your option for today and a better tomorrow. Our internet address is parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio. In the limelight.
In the United States, special counsel Jack Smith has countered Donald Trump's attempts to wriggle out of the election subversion case. We take a look at the U.S. media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. National broadcaster CBS News has covered this story and tells us more. Special counsel Jack Smith is rebutting attempts by former President Donald Trump to have the election-related indictment against him dismissed in Washington, D.C. According to court filings docketed on Monday, 6th of November, no other president has engaged in conspiracy and obstruction to overturn valid election results and illegitimately retain power, prosecutors wrote in a nearly 80-page document. The indictment squarely charges the defendant for his conduct, and the defendant's constitutional and statutory challenges to it are meritless. The special counsel Jack Smith was responding to a set of motions by Trump's legal team asking federal judge Tanya Chutkan to dismiss the four federal charges filed against the former president in Washington, D.C. earlier this year. Those charges included conspiracy to defraud the United States and conspiracy to obstruct Congress's certification of President Joe Biden's 2020 election victory. Donald Trump pleaded not guilty to all the charges and denied wrongdoing, while characterizing the case as politically motivated. Last month, Trump's lawyers argued that the former president was in part engaging in constitutionally protected speech during the conduct alleged in the indictment and his past Senate impeachment trial, which did not end in a conviction and therefore precluded further criminal prosecution. They wrote that the former president is a target of selective and vindictive prosecution and asked the court to strike allegations in the indictment related to actions at the Capitol on 6th of January 2021. But in Monday, 6th of November's court filings, prosecutors countered each of the claims, arguing Donald Trump used deceit, trickery, or dishonest means to push his scheme to defraud the United States after the 2020 election, based on accusations that Trump knowingly made false statements to the public and government officials. Any speech that the defendant used to carry out the conspiracy, fraud, and obstruction crimes charged in the indictment is categorically excluded from the protections of the First Amendment, prosecutors wrote. The special counsel's arguments on Monday included some of the most explicit references the prosecutor has made connecting Donald Trump to the U.S. Capitol siege, for which more than 1,100 people have been charged. Jack Smith alleged in his first filing that Donald Trump directed a large crowd to the Capitol on 6th of January 2021 and later exploited the violence. In his second court filing on Monday, 6th of November, the special counsel wrote that the 6th of January was the day that each of the defendants' criminal conspiracies came to a head, and argued those events were included in the indictment because they provided necessary context for the criminal conduct with which he's charged. Jack Smith also emphasized Trump's ongoing support and championing of January 6 defendants, writing Trump has promoted and extolled the events of that day. While the violent attack was ongoing, the defendant told rioters that they were very special and that we love you. In the years since then, Jack Smith continued, Donald Trump has championed rioters as great patriots and proclaimed 6th of January 2021 as a beautiful day. In court filings and on his social media, the former president has alleged the case against him is politically motivated and meant to target him during the presidential election. But Jack Smith pushed back in another court filing on Monday, arguing the indictment is predicated on facts and law and not animus. This prosecution stands upon the bedrock principle of equal justice under law, the special counsel contended. The defendant's sweeping claims of selective and vindictive prosecution are unsupported by any evidence and lack any merit. Trump's attempts to dismiss the case are not his first. The former president is also urging Judge Tanya Chutkan to toss the indictment based on claims of presidential immunity, arguing he's shielded from prosecution because the actions described in the indictment occurred whilst he was president. The judge has yet to rule on that argument, but in the meantime, Donald Trump's defense team has asked her to pause the case until she issues an order. Trial in the case is currently set for March, and Jack Smith's team wrote in a separate court filing on Monday, 6th of November, that prosecutors opposed the requested stay in the case. American newspaper The Daily Beast has also covered the same story. Prosecutors in Donald Trump's Washington, D.C. election subversion trial filed a rebuttal against his request to dismiss charges as meritless, writing, the defendant stands alone in American history for his alleged crimes. No other president has engaged in conspiracy and obstruction to overturn valid election results and illegitimately retain power. Donald Trump had previously claimed that because his attempt to influence the election failed, he shouldn't be accused of wrongdoing. However, special counsel Jack Smith's team countered, providing the analogy that robbers would still be charged even if they were captured en route to a bank robbery. They continued, a conspiracy can be committed even if the object of the conspiracy is unattainable. Jack Smith also rejected Donald Trump's First Amendment defenses because he didn't just lie in saying the 2020 election was stolen, instead launching attacks at the proper function of the government process by blaming specific states like Georgia for counting dead non-resident, non-citizen, or otherwise ineligible voters. The former president's lawyers have 10 days to reply before U.S. District Judge Tanya Chutkan makes a ruling on the dismissal motion. Trump's trial is set to begin on 4th of March. The British newspaper The Independent has also covered the same story. Prosecutors with Special Counsel Jack Smith's office are calling on Judge Tanya Chutkan to reject former President Donald Trump's efforts to have the election subversion and conspiracy charges against him dismissed, writing in a Monday 6th of November court filing that Mr. Trump stands alone in American history for his alleged crimes, and pointing out that cases cited by the ex-president's lawyers don't support the arguments that they've made. No other president has engaged in conspiracy and obstruction to overturn valid election results and illegitimately retain power. The indictment squarely charges the defendant for his conduct, and the defendant's constitutional and statutory challenges to it are meritless. In the 79-page court filing opposing two separate motions filed by Mr. Trump's legal team, Assistant Special Counsels James Pierce, John Pelletieri, and Senior Assistant Special Counsels Thomas Windham and Molly Gaston noted that the indictment returned against the ex-president by a Washington, D.C. grand jury over the summer accused him of perpetrating an unprecedented campaign of deceit to attack the very functioning of the federal government, to collect, count, and certify votes, to obstruct the January 6th congressional proceeding, at which the election results are certified, and to disenfranchise millions of American voters. They further described Donald Trump's actions as part of a concerted criminal effort to overturn the presidential election results and prevent the lawful transfer of power to his successor. Last month, Trump's attorneys filed the two separate motions to dismiss the charges on both constitutional and statutory grounds, including by claiming that he has permanent immunity for any acts that he undertook as president, and by arguing that his acquittal at the end of his second impeachment trial by the U.S. Senate bars him from being charged criminally for any conduct relating to his efforts to overturn the election. But prosecutors now say those filings only reflect the fact that Mr. Trump cannot mount meritorious challenges to the charges against him, and derided the former president's arguments as relying on distortions and misrepresentations in an attempt to rewrite the charges against him as being for wholly innocuous, perhaps even admirable conduct. And prosecutors summarily rejected the idea that Mr. Trump's actions amounted to merely political speech protected by the First Amendment. The allegations that the defendant sought to overturn the result of the 2020 presidential election by resorting to fraud, deceit, and corruption places conduct well outside of the protections afforded by the First Amendment, and likewise put him on notice that his conduct was criminal and thus subject to prosecution.
Wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
Gaza Strip skyline. Israel's bombing campaign continues. An apocalyptic scene. It appears Israel is using the banned white phosphorus bombs again. Bombs which burns the skin down to the bone. The death toll continues to mount, like at the Al-Maghazi camp. 51 Palestinians murdered. Another massacre on top of the others. Genocide on speed. The cries over the loss of a beloved one, which is why people are angry worldwide. But the biggest rally for Palestinians ever to have taken place in Washington, D.C. The war is coming at a cost for Israel. Diplomatically, Bolivia cut off relations with Israel, with Turkey, Colombia, Chad, and Honduras recalling their ambassadors. Persian Gulf Arab leaders meeting with the U.S. Secretary of State. They all called for a ceasefire, but Blinken did not blink. No to a ceasefire, and on a humanitarian pause, a big maybe.
It's our view that a ceasefire now would simply leave Hamas in place.
Yet Blinken had only echoed Netanyahu's statements on a ceasefire.
Calls for a ceasefire are calls for Israel to surrender to Hamas.
David Petraeus, the retired general of the U.S. Army, responsible in part for his failure in Afghanistan and also in Iraq, in a leaked audio file, encouraged and approved Israel's carnage in Gaza.
I see no alternative to the destruction of Hamas, and I use that term specifically because, as Aviv knows, there's a military doctrinal term. It's a gradation. You know, you can disrupt, you can deny, you can defeat, you can destroy.
But he must not have been prepared for what an Israeli minister said when asked whether an atomic bomb should be dropped on the Gaza Strip. Amihai Eliyahu said this is one of the possibilities. Let's not forget, the Gaza Strip has already been hit by an atomic bomb. But not at once. Slowly, 25,000 tons dropped on the Strip so far. The resistance fighters slammed these comments as reflective of the evil and terrorist nature of the regime, while they fought street battles against the Israeli regime forces. Israel has suffered casualties as a result. The tide may be turning, with costs mounting for the U.S. and Israel. For Israel, the worldwide anti-Israel protests have shattered its image. These protests have also worked against the U.S.
It's definitely ceasefire. People are getting killed every minute.
In the U.S., there are worries about the aftermath of the war. It's time for Israel's friends to recognize that the current operational approach is causing an unacceptable level of civilian harm and does not appear likely to achieve the goal of permanently ending the threat from Hamas, is what this high-ranking senator said. In other words, the U.S. is at the phase of the war where people are starting to worry about how they will look when this is over. And they are worried about votes also, as cynical as that sounds. Muslim and Arab American groups have threatened to not vote for Biden in 2024. This includes Democratic Party leaders from contested states that can decide elections, such as Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. That, combined with the sanctioning of Israeli products, which has also gained traction, especially amongst the Generation Zs in the U.S., and not just in the U.S., but around the world. Figures reported by the charity organization Save the Children shows the number of children killed in the Gaza Strip as a result of Israel's ongoing aggression has exceeded annual figures related to global conflicts over the past 4 years. The international NGO says that Israel's brutal military attack against Gaza, which began on October 7 in response to an operation by the Palestinian resistance group Hamas, has so far killed more than the annual number of children killed in armed conflicts globally in each of the past 4 years. According to multiple reports, including the Palestinian Health Ministry and the Defense for Children International, DCI, one child is being killed in Gaza every 10 minutes. EuroMed Human Rights Monitor said in a press release on October 18 that since the launch of the indiscriminate bombing crusade against Gaza, an average of 100 children have been killed daily. Hundreds of children are still trapped under the rubble of residential buildings targeted during Israel's strikes on Gaza, and they have not been rescued yet, which implies the actual death toll could be higher. The UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs said in a statement that at least 1,000 children are missing under the rubble in Gaza. The ongoing siege and the relentless bombardment are impeding search and rescue operations.
Gaza has become a graveyard for children. It's a living hell for everyone else. And yet the threats to children go beyond bombs and mortars. And I want to speak briefly now on two of those, water and trauma. The more than 1 million children of Gaza have a critical water crisis. Gaza's water production now, its capacity is at 5% of its daily output. So child deaths to dehydration, particularly infant deaths to dehydration, are a growing threat.
The UN Committee on the Rights of the Child has also issued a statement saying grave human rights violations against children are mounting by the minutes in the Gaza Strip. The statement says armed conflict harms children first and foremost and has lifelong effects on their physical and mental health, their development, and ultimately the enjoyment of all their rights. Children are also harmed when they survive, but lose parents and other family members and friends, and also witness catastrophic events. The committee has also called for an end to the devastating harm that's being leveled on children's lives in the occupied Palestinian territory. It has also called on all parties to protect all children and to provide all the necessary medical and protective support, including psychological support, to begin the long process of overcoming the consequences of these grave violations.
Then, of course, we have the trauma. When finally the fighting stops, the cost to children and their communities is going to be borne out for generations to come. Before this latest escalation, before it, more than 800,000 children in Gaza, that's three quarters of the entire child population of Gaza, were identified as needing mental health and psychological support. Again, that's before this latest nightmare.
In a desperate move, Palestinian children and their parents have started writing their names on their bodies in black ink so that they can be identified in hospitals if they are killed or injured in Israeli strikes. Children pulled from the wreckage of buildings are sometimes unrecognizable due to grave injuries. Heartbreaking photos of children lying on steel trays inside Gaza hospital morgues with their sleeves or legs of trousers pushed up to reveal their names have been going viral on social media. The UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, said in a report last Tuesday that almost every child in Gaza has been exposed to deeply distressing events and trauma.
We're talking about children witnessing their parents, their families, their sisters and brothers being killed in front of them, their houses, their communities disappearing in a split second. This has a big toll on their emotional, psychological, and mental health.
The report highlighted that children are experiencing widespread destruction, relentless attacks, displacement, and severe shortages of essential necessities like food, water, and medicine. The report added that without stable electricity and fuel supplies, essential facilities like hospitals, desalination plants, and water pumping stations cannot work properly.
It's interesting, Amy, we have a formula at the United Nations that is applied to virtually every other conflict situation. But when it comes to the situation in Israel and Palestine, there's a different set of rules, apparently. And that's, I think, a big source of my frustration. Where is the transitional justice process? Where is the UN protection force to protect all civilians? Where is the tribunal for accountability? Where is the action on the part of the Security Council, the only mechanism in the United Nations that has enforcement to ensure protection in the occupied territories?
Since October the 7th, Israel has launched a relentless bombing campaign against the people of Gaza. The bombardments have claimed the lives of thousands of innocent Palestinians, most of them women and children. Israel's genocidal war on the people of Palestine has sparked mass rallies across the world. Journalists, activists, and even athletes have joined the growing calls to put an end to the carnage. But most of these voices are being suppressed due to the pressure by Israel and Zionist lobbies. Reports have been circulating at an alarming pace about activists being sacked from their positions, journalists being relieved of their duties, and even athletes being stripped of their contracts. The editor-in-chief of an academic journal said that he was fired from his job after sharing an article about people dying in Gaza. Michael Eisen, a geneticist at the University of California, Berkeley, and the editor of the scientific journal eLife, tweeted to say that he had been informed that he is being replaced as the publication's editor. Egyptian TikToker Karim Kabani said he had been sacked from his job in France because he made three videos on TikTok in support of the people of Palestine. Jackson Frank, who was recently appointed as the Sixers beat writer for Philly Voice, was relieved of his duties after sending out a tweet in solidarity with the people of Palestine. Frank, a vocal supporter of Palestine, in one of his tweets, days after his unceremonious sacking, termed the Israeli atrocities against the people in Gaza as, quote, genocide. In the Canadian city of Ontario, the New Democratic Party, NDP, expelled MPP Sarah Jama from the caucus earlier this week for her statements in support of Palestinians.
Governments and institutions in Canada are trying to use their voice to wait and wait to silence us, to silence workers, students, educators, and peace-loving people who dare to support Palestine. And to every person who's taking a risk to speak up for Palestinian dignity and safety, I see you and I hear you and I am with you. They try hard to silence us, but we know that our words are powerful and we must continue to speak up no matter the cost.
In a series of tweets, Sarah Jama called for an immediate ceasefire and de-escalation. Mahad Akhil, one of the top agents in Hollywood, also had to call it quits from her role at the Creative Artists Agency, CAA, after she posted in support of Palestine. And Tanya Singh, a unionist from Minneapolis, said she had been terminated from her job in a union for anti-Semitism over her support for Palestine.
Governments across the world, in an attempt to address anti-Semitism and somehow redress the horrors of the Holocaust, are allowing Israel to get away with apartheid, ethnic cleansing, detention of children, torture, restriction of movement and other freedoms, and the illegal occupation of land. After every genocide, the world cries out, "Never again!" And yet here you see another attempted genocide unfold right in front of your eyes, and you don't just watch on quietly, but actively supporting the oppressor.
Meanwhile, the crisis in Gaza has unveiled Western double standards regarding the issue of Palestinians and their cause. Western nations have tried their best to silence pro-Palestine voices. Germany, for example, has in recent weeks moved hysterically to ban pro-Palestine demonstrations altogether, smearing them as quote-unquote anti-Semitic gatherings. Berlin has violently cracked down on Palestinian activists. French Interior Minister Gerald Darmanin has declared an outright ban on all Palestine-related protests. In addition, those standing in solidarity with the Palestinian cause are also reportedly being stopped, questioned and fined. In the UK, the Rishi Sunak government has come out openly in support of the Israeli regime's genocidal campaign in the besieged Gaza Strip. Home Secretary Suella Braverman insisted that waving the Palestinian flag could amount to inciting racism or violence. At the same time, Prime Minister Sunak demanded all state buildings should display the Israeli flag. The response by the European officials to the massacre in the Gaza Strip and the subsequent intensifications of the siege and the indiscriminate bombing of civilians by Tel Aviv has laid bare the hypocrisy of the European leaders and their blatant bias towards Israel.
We know for sure that we represent the views of the majority of people in Ireland. We represent the views of our Parliament, and we genuinely believe that we represent the views of the majority of European citizens who have taken to the streets in their tens and hundreds of thousands over the past number of days, appalled by the stance of the EU so-called leaders who have been complicit in genocide and ethnic cleansing by allowing Israel to behave as it does.
Just days ago, more than 800 EU officials wrote a letter to the bloc's chief, Ursula von der Leyen, criticizing her uncontrolled support of Israel. The signatories of the letter said there is a seeming indifference demonstrated over the past few days by our institution towards the ongoing massacre of civilians in the Gaza Strip in disregard for human rights and international humanitarian law. The letter represents deep division within the bloc on how to approach the Israel-Gaza war.
Choose to think better. Welcome to a better you. Visit us at parstoday.ir/en. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
Europe's shameful complicity in the Zionist regime's war on Gaza is quite clear. Today, European leaders have remained silent amid the Zionist regime's disproportionate bombardment of Gaza, while implicitly condoning the murderous language being used by the Zionist regime's officials. Regarding this issue, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, the latest stage of the massacre in Gaza has revealed an unexpected moral bankruptcy on the part of the European Union's institutions and almost all of its member states. In the past, Europe used to make efforts to mitigate Washington's blind pro-Zionist stance and to advance the Palestinian cause, such as during the drafting of the 2003 Roadmap to Peace. Two decades later, the EU and its top shareholders are barely recognizable. The last 20 years included the Second Intifada, Israel's destructive wars on Gaza with massive Palestinian civilian casualties, thousands of home demolitions, and creeping annexation through settlement growth in the occupied West Bank and East Al-Quds. Gaza has also been subject to a harsh blockade since 2007. Under these circumstances, logic would dictate that European support for Palestinians should have increased. Instead, Europe has become increasingly pro-Israel, or, in the best case, indifferent to the Palestinian cause. It speaks volumes that in the last two decades, the only significant EU measure has been, brace yourself, to request a change in labeling of the Zionist regime's products, ensuring that goods produced in illegal settlements are labeled as such. This was less than a slap on the wrist, but it still sparked Israeli indignation. The EU's political discourse on Palestinian rights has slowly adjusted to the Zionist regime's increasingly far-right narrative, with dissent and different opinions silenced or strongly criticized by mainstream media. The mere use of the word occupation or any objection to the Zionist regime's violence is equated with anti-Semitism. This charge is systematically used for character assassinations of pro-Palestinian politicians and activists through complacent Western media. Jeremy Corbyn, the former British Labour leader, is a prime example. Today, the Labour leadership's stance on the Zionist regime Palestine issue is barely distinguishable from Likud's, and Muslim voters are fleeing the party in droves. Other European parties across the political spectrum have followed the same path. A complete metamorphosis has taken place. Many explanations could be provided, but ultimately, European politicians stand with the Zionist regime because they seem to get in less trouble that way.
This conflict did not begin on October 7th. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres had to shake the Europeans from their guilty torpor by reminding them recently that the attacks by Hamas did not happen in a vacuum. He said, "The Palestinian people have been subjected to 56 years of suffocating occupation. They have seen their land steadily devoured by settlements and plagued by violence, their economy stifled, their people displaced, and their homes demolished. Their hopes for a political solution to their plight have been vanishing." For these common sense words, the Zionist regime demanded Guterres' resignation. Meanwhile, a procession of European leaders have rightly traveled to the occupied territories called Israel to express their solidarity, including the presidents of the European Commission and European Parliament, the German Chancellor, the French President, the British Prime Minister, and the Italian Prime Minister. But we have not seen a similar procession of visits to Ramallah, as the Zionist regime's bombs continue to rain down on Gaza. On the European moral scale, Israeli pain is rated higher than Palestinian pain, and it appears nothing is going to change it. The European position is that Hamas committed an unprovoked act of terrorism, while the fabricated regime of Israel is just exercising its legitimate right of self-defense. However, the Zionist regime's right to self-defense, as they claim, must be contextualized within its role as an occupying power for more than five decades, during which it has harassed, humiliated, and killed countless Palestinians. This is the point Guterres was attempting to convey in his heavily criticized remark, especially to Western regimes, those champions of the rules-based world order. It is worth remembering that when Palestinians last held a mass peaceful protest, the 2018 Great March of Return, which followed the provocative U.S. decision to move its embassy to Al-Quds, the Zionist regime's army fired upon thousands of Palestinians gathered at the Gaza fence. The Zionist regime's snipers killed more than 200 Palestinians, including medics and journalists, and wounded thousands more. This was a despicable act, a crime, but no condemnation came from Western regimes. Today, European leaders have remained silent amid the Zionist regime's disproportionate bombardment of Gaza, while implicitly condoning the murderous language being used by the Zionist regime's officials, including President Isaac Herzog, who has said, "There are no innocent civilians in Gaza." He said, "It is an entire nation out there that is responsible," tacitly justifying their collective punishment. Of course, thousands of Palestinian flags are being hoisted by European citizens, largely unreported by Western mainstream media across European capitals. People are doing what their governments will not, condemning the Zionist regime's disproportionate retaliation and the collective punishment of Gaza's Palestinian population through indiscriminate bombing and the cutting of water, electricity, fuel, and food deliveries. All European institutions have been able to utter amid heavy public pressure are bland extortions for the Zionist regime to abide by international law. This is too little, too late, and too hypocritical.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم
السلام عليكم ورحمة الله
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
همه با وجود قده سرطانی اسرائیل مخالفیم.
All of us are opposed to the cancerous tumor Israel.
وجه مشترک همه وحدت امت اسلامی.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
The following is the part of the speech delivered by the leader of the Islamic Revolution in a meeting with President Raisi and his cabinet on August 30, 2023, on the occasion of Government Week. I would like to mention a couple of things regarding foreign interactions and international policies. An important point is that opportunities exist in our relations with different countries. The agreements that are made, the cooperation agreements that are made and signed, should not remain something just on paper. The government has long-term cooperation agreements with some countries. So, where are they now? What has been the result of this? Don't let these cooperation agreements and documents remain something that is merely on paper. This is important. Another point to note is that when we speak of having interactions with the world, there are some political elements in the country that believe the world is made up of just several countries, mainly the Western countries. That's how they see the world.
دنیای اسلام یک
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
According to these individuals, if we have warm, friendly relations with those countries, it is as though we have relations with all the world. If we reduce our relations with them, even by a small amount, it is as though we have no relations with the world. This is wrong. This view is a reactionary view. It belongs to 100 years ago when a few European countries controlled the world. Having relations with them meant having relations with the entire world. A century has passed since then, and this outdated reactionary view needs to be put aside today. Having relations with the world means having relations with Africa, South America, and Asia. There are places where an immense amount of human and natural resources exist. Western countries mostly became rich by putting pressure on African countries and other such countries. Europe has actually gained its wealth by stealing the wealth of African countries and some Asian countries. We must not neglect these countries, and we should have relations with them. Therefore, the criterion for international relations is our nation's interests and honor. National honor is very important, and domination and submission should not exist in our relations. We are against both domination and submission.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. You've done for
follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/ParsTodayEN. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/ParsTodayEnglish.
Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Iruba Shavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Pourreza, London.
Rasha Saglam, Istanbul.
Saeed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
As part of a diplomatic dash across West Asia, the U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken arrived in Ankara and met with his Turkish counterpart Hakan Fidan. The visit comes one day ahead of the Turkish police raiding pro-Palestinian protesters who tried entering the Incirlik airbase, which hosts U.S. troops, with tear gas and water cannons. Demonstrators condemned the U.S. unconditional support for Israel in its aggression against Palestinians, stressing the U.S. is Israel's partner in the genocide taking place in Gaza.
The fierce Israeli attacks against Palestinians are due to the United States' unlimited support to Netanyahu's cabinet. If the U.S. did not support Israel from the first place, we wouldn't see them committing such massacres openly and not even thinking of the consequences. I think the only way a ceasefire or pause can be achieved if the U.S. stops its blind support to the Israeli government in its aggression on Gaza. The United States must use its influence to push for peace, not war. And the huge rallies we've seen in the U.S. and the American public refusing to fund massacres and genocides will push the Biden administration to stop its support to Israel.
In a speech made during his visit to his hometown, Rize, the Turkish president said his country has never left the brothers in Gaza unprotected, helpless and alone, and will never do so. Erdogan said that it is Turkey's duty to protect the holy sites in Jerusalem al-Quds. He added that Israel has taken a very wrongful step by which it has darkened its future.
It is our duty to save our Palestinian brothers from Israeli oppression and to stop the massacres committed in Gaza before the eyes of the world.
Turkey has been strongly condemning Israeli aggression on Gaza, which has killed more than 10,000 Palestinians, most of them women and children. Ankara has withdrawn its ambassador in Israel and strongly condemned the Israeli aggression on Gaza. The country's President Erdogan has also threatened to call Israel a war criminal. But there has still been no clear and official statement on cutting ties with the occupying regime. Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
On Monday, a conference called Religions on Peace and War was held at Rome's Luis Guido Carli University, considered one of the most distinguished private research institutes in Italy.